On ABC Radio,
this is The Big Fish
with Scott Levi.
Ahoy there, welcome aboard. We'll drop the Kellick and have another chat about the recreational pastime that we love, fishing. And Stinker's back this morning. He shares his sympathies with the latest shark attack victim. Awful story there. And his thoughts on shark culling, along with the history of that practice. A dire health warning for all of us oyster lovers. If you love them in New South Wales, you've got to listen to this warning, because they could be very dangerous if you don't know the provenance. And our first cast takes you to Evans Head, a great spot on the north coast, with local fisher Haldon Boyd. Heading to beautiful Evans Head this morning on The Big Fish, and a long-time local, Haldon Boyd. Good morning.
Good morning, Scotty.
Haldon, we're going to talk about the Evans Head Fishing Classic, which has really had a great resurrection as a catch-and-release and photograph tournament, a very sustainable tournament. But sadly, you've had tragedy in the area. You know the area very well, with a rock fisher swept to his death. What do we know about that situation?
Yes, Scott, that's very sad but very poignant incident. It happened last Saturday at a location known as Goanna Headland, just south of Evans Head, the river mouth there, at a place called Flat Rock. And Flat Rock is renowned for its swell characteristics that come and go. And at the time of this particular incident, there wasn't much of a swell around. It was only about 1.5 metres, and it was an outgoing tide. And this chap in his 40s, who his family has requested his name not be released at this point in time, he was fishing alone on the rock platform and sadly got swept into the sea. And he was spotted by walkers about 300 metres offshore. The emergency services were called, and the local volunteer members of the Evans Head Surf Club, who are held in high regard, sent teams out there that located the man and commenced CPR on him, taking him back to Shark Bay, which is on the southern side of the Evans Head breakwall. But very sadly, he didn't make it through.
Are life jackets mandatory there?
They most certainly are. Back in 2015, if I can go back into history a little bit, Randwick City Council had nine fishing deaths from rock anglers, and there was a coronial inquest into that, and the recommendations of the coroner, which were taken up by the New South Wales State Government at the time, was that they would introduce a rock fishing life jacket law and declared areas under the New South Wales Act, and it was given a one-year trial period so that authorities such as police, Maritime New South Wales Fisheries, National Parks and Wildlife Service and local council rangers could go and speak to anglers who were on the rocks to say, look, you know, this is coming into effect at the end of 2016. And allowing the opportunity, if they wanted to continue this activity, to make sure that they were wearing approved life jackets after November 2016, which was law.
Well, it's amazing, isn't it, that fishing, the sport that we love so much and we talk about on this program, recreational pursuit, the sport, whatever you want to call it, is the most dangerous recreational pursuit in the country. We've had 125 deaths in the last 20 years or so, countless fatalities before that, just too many to name. And the trend is that it's the vast majority of victims are men between the ages of 25 and 49. That's according to the Randwick Council, who, as you said, had such a problem. You know, wearing a life jacket, it may not save you, but it's a good start, isn't it? I think also wearing the ones that are already inflated, you know, just a nice slimline buoyancy vest that's approved, that fits the Australian standard and is up to scratch, unlike the ones where you pull a tab or self-inflating. I mean, particularly those self-inflating ones, if you cop a big wave, you may not want it to go up.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Because with rocks, so if you get knocked off your feet, you know, the inflatable ones can get jagged and not be useful in any way, shape or form. You know, I prefer to wear the ones around my neck, of course, which you don't have to do that. But the other thing too, Scott, is that if you do wear the inflatable ones, you know, by gas bottles and that sort of stuff, every 12 months you have to have them inspected and passed again. And, I mean, that costs a fisherman $50. And if there's any defects, well, that's an additional cost. But even so, I mean, you know, that sort of checking and stuff just for, you know, personal comfort and that sort of stuff is really well worth.
Well, I've had so many of those just from my experience, Halden, and I do get on the boat on my own a lot or on the kayak on my own, so I have to wear one when I do that. Don't do much rock fishing these days, more beach fishing, but I've had so many of the ones with the gas bottle, and now I just wear the life jacket. It's nice and slim. You just get used to putting it on. Every time you're in the boat on your own, you put it on. Every time you're on the kayak, you put it on. But funny story, I got one of those very expensive ones when they first came out, the self-inflating, and I was in the bedroom and I had a little boy at the time who was a little mischievous. He would have been 5 or 6, and I hear this whoosh and boom out in the lounge room. I come running down the hallway and he's running up the hallway shouting, "I didn't do it, I didn't do it."
And my son Dan did exactly the same.
Yeah, and he's pulled the tab, and there's the air's full of talcum powder, and there's the inflated vest, which is pretty hard to put back and redo. So I thought, no, just the permanent one is the go, isn't it? They really are an absolute lifesaver, and even then they may not save your life, but a lot of people have been saved by them. And what are some of the characteristics of the rock shelves around Evans Head?
Well, it depends on each area. Like, there are 22 local government areas in New South Wales, Scott, and only 9, would you believe, are adhering to this rock fishing life jacket law, which, you know, I mean, it's mandatory.
And it's interesting. Many of them had the excuses. Look, we just don't have the ranges. We don't have the resources to police it. But there are many, many laws where that's the case too. But we're a pretty law-abiding mob, and we generally look out for each other. And if you're on a rock platform where it's mandated, people will say, "Hey, mate, you better get a life jacket. It's for your own good."
It does come down to common sense, doesn't it, Scott?
It does.
The other thing too is that, you know, there are a lot of rock platforms and favourite fishing spots where dedicated fishermen have actually gone down there and put in bolts and, you know, loop eyes and things like that, so people can actually take a rope down there and wrap it around themselves just in case. But even so, you know, it's best to take a buddy with you. The other thing too is that if you've got kids with you under the age of 12, you have to ensure they wear life jackets if they're fetching bait for you and all that sort of stuff. But getting back to this particular place called Flat Rock, which is south of Evans Head, as I said, going to Headland, which surprisingly was created back in 1985 through an Aboriginal land claim number one in New South Wales, where 365 hectares were actually given for public recreation, the promotion of Aboriginal cultural heritage and protection of flora and fauna and the like in public recreation. And it's a very tricky headland because it starts facing north right through down to Snapper Rock facing direct south. And the swells there are all over the shop. And the location where this happened, near Flat Rock, where the people spotted this bloke out to sea, is called Joggly Point. And you get swells coming in there and they just joggle all over the point, all over the place. And you just don't, if you're not a local and if you don't understand the way it works, it's so easy to get swept in. Like, you know, you get swells coming in sets of maybe 4, 5, 6. And at this particular point, Flat Rock, it's a mid-tide flat rock, which drops off to about 70 feet or 20 metres, 25 metres of water. And that's a fabulous fishing
spot.
Yeah,
well, that's a spot where you'd definitely have a chance at a land-based Spanish mackerel or a long tail or one of those other deep-water pelagics.
Oh, most certainly. Mackerel and on the full moon, you know, I mean... mull away and all that sort of stuff, and you get snapper off there and all sorts of different fish. But the thing is that with this flat rock, it's so deceptive because even if the tide is below the level and you get a set of, say, 5 or 6 waves, as I said, and they come in and the first one comes in and it breaks, and you might have about 6 inches in the old scale or 15 centimetres of water going across, that runs back off. And the next one is a little bit bigger. Next thing you have 30 to 50 centimetres. That all washes off the rock and then you get your first big set. Then you might have 1 metre going over the top and the next one's bigger and you get absolutely knocked off your feet. The power of the water is absolutely amazing. And, you know, I mean, rock on those places, you need to wear a life jacket, wear cleats if you can, because it's so slippery, because there's lots of weed and that sort of stuff.
Yeah, it's interesting to look at that place and you look at the satellite maps and things. You've got miles and miles of pristine beaches with gutters. Why would you risk it, Haldon? We're speaking with Haldon Boyd from Evans Head about a rock fishing death, a terrible tragedy for that family, and our thoughts go out to everyone bereaved. It's just awful that someone goes off for a fish and doesn't come home, but it's a story that we keep reporting on and reporting on and reporting on, and just be so careful. And I think, you know, we've really stopped talking a great deal about rock fishing on The Big Fish, Haldon, because it's just so dangerous and you've got to know so much and you've got to, you know, even then you might be with an experienced fisho, you might be an experienced fisho, you might be wearing a wetsuit and cleats and have the PFD on and you can still get into trouble. It's a very, very dangerous environment, isn't it? And that spot sounds like it can really get you.
Most certainly is, Scott. And I mean, I even take an EPIRB with me, which can be activated if I actually fall into the water. But I mean, there are escape points too on these little flat rock platforms, but you just have to be a local to know it. And if you get washed in, if you freak out and you just don't know what you're doing, it can end up into a situation which sadly has happened here.
And a lot of locals surf and swim there too. You know, they know that if they do go in, I've got to swim around here, I've got a fair swim to get to a spot where I can get out. So you've got to be prepared to have a swim. You've got to know your escape route if you're in the water. That's so true. It's the Big Fish with Haldon Boyd from Evans Head. And on a brighter note, Haldon, there's a terrific fishing tournament coming up. Entries have just opened for the Evans Head Classic, and they've really revamped that. And we'll come back in just a moment and have a chat about it, because it's an event to be proud of now. And I think it's also going to be a very important event for education when it comes to rock fishing safety and also looking after the environment. So hang with us. We'll be back with Haldon at Evans Head, which we don't mention too much on the Big Fish, but you reckon it's a hot spot, mate?
Yes, it most certainly is. And the Fishing Classic has been going for 30 years and it's just getting bigger and better, and we'll chat shortly.
The Big Fish with Scott Levi on ABC Radio.
Blues wait you. I'm going fishing. I'm going fishing. So if you can't wait, just get you some bait and come go fishing with me. I love my boogie woogie. I love to play my jazz. But I need a break. I'm going down to the lake and get me a wide mouth bass. I'm going fishing. I'm going fishing. So if you can't wait, just grab some bait and come go fishing with me.
It's the Big Fish, and Haldon Boyd from Evans Head is with us. And Haldon, talking about the Evans Head Classic, and it was an event that started to get a bad name, I believe, at one stage for too many fish being killed and glory hunting. And now it's really sustainable and a catch and photograph event. You can still keep a snapper for a feed or whatever, but it's a much better family event now, I believe.
It most certainly is. The Evans Head Fishing Classic, which has been organised by Fishing Tournaments Australia. It originally started by the Evans Head Chamber of Commerce, which was looking for a way of attracting people that loved fishing and want to spend a little bit of winter time and space with their family and friends. It's going to be held on the 3rd to the 10th of July this year, the 30th year. And they've actually, after a long time, they've locked it in to be within the Queensland and New South Wales school holidays, which is really, really quite good. And it's a wonderful event. It's initially it was a weigh-in event, and of course there were a lot of problems with that, with people doctoring fish and all of that sort of stuff by putting sinkers down their throat and all the like. But this event now is a photograph with a brag mat, which is supplied to everybody who actually enters the event, and it's on the length of the fish and not the weight, and it's all on release of fish. Of course, if you go out fishing, whether it be on the rocks or in a boat or in the estuary or whatever, you can still take fish and have a good feed with the family and that sort of stuff, but it really is a good family event. And over the years, there have been many wonderful initiatives, like having environmental groups coming in, like Australian Seabird and Turtle Rescue, to talk about correct disposal of, you know, excess fishing tackle and all that sort of stuff. And it really has become an educational thing. And it's held at the local RSL club, the Woodburn Evanshead RSL club, and has been for many, many, many years now, over 20 years. And it's known as Club Evans these days with the trendy name changes and the like. And it really is a wonderful family event.
Oh, just wonderful, a catch and photograph event. And I think that they do a lot of mystery lengths and things, don't they? It's not so much now on who kills the most fish, which is a bit of a problem with the old ways. So it's great that they've got with the new way of doing it. And what sort of numbers do you think they could draw? I mean, goes from Friday the 3rd to the Friday after that.
The 10th.
So it's a week-long event. So you can sort of fish at your leisure too, I guess, during the holidays. You can give it every day or a couple of days.
That's exactly right. And, you know, I mean, it's turned into an environmentally friendly event, as I've mentioned. And the organisers really realised the significance of being able to catch and release the bigger fish, which are the breeders and the like, and especially the estuary fish, like the flathead, brim, and that sort of stuff as well. And, you know, it's all about educating kids to plan for fishing for the future and to make everything fishing enjoyable and very, very sustainable.
That's great. And you never know, you might get the mystery length or something, or win the random draw. I was just looking at the results from last year, and it said Evanshead Fishing Classic overall adult results of broken hearts, sore arms, and the ones that didn't get away. And they've got categories for Ludric, and categories for brim and tarwine and flathead. And so it doesn't matter where you fish, mulloway. Oh, gee, that's a pretty big one, actually. 1 meter, 32 centimeters was the biggest mulloway last year. So we'll see how they go. But thanks for telling us about it. Haldon, are you going to have a crack, mate?
Most certainly. But I would advise everybody that's coming along to Evanshead to enjoy a wonderful classic in its 30th year to make sure you have the right gear. And if you're going to go rock angling, make sure you wear a life jacket.
Absolutely. Thanks for telling us about beautiful Evanshead. I'd say a few people will be heading on their annual pilgrimage with the family up that way. And a good thing to do is maybe have a couple of days in the Evanshead Fishing Classic. Haldon Boyd, thanks for joining us on The Big Fish.
Tight lines, mate.
Went fishing last Sunday and I caught a smelt. Put him in the pan and the fire he felt. Of all the smells I ever smelt.
Well?
I never smelt a smelt like that smelt.
As the salmon swam up the river to spawn,
yeah,
he said to himself with a great big yawn,
ho-ho,
the next time I come up this way,
I'm gonna make the trip in a Chevrolet. Oh-ho!
This is The Big Fish with Scott Levi on ABC Radio.
On ABC Radio, it's The Big Fish with Scott Levi.
Here comes Stinker with his fishing tips. Some hot advice for your fishing trip. Where to find him? What's the bait?
Are you catching any, mate?
Good morning, Stinker.
Hey, g'day, Scott.
Sharks are really in the news at the moment. People are worried about them and there are calls for culling and all the rest of it. There's been culling in your part of the world back in the day, hasn't there? Massive slaughter of sharks.
Yes, Scott. It's a very emotive issue, particularly after the dreadful incident at Coogee. And when I speak about sharks, I think about those who've really suffered. And it's a horrific incident that I can't really imagine. But when I speak about sharks, I always consider those people. But all I can really tell you and our listeners is what has happened here in Port Stephens over all the years with sharks. Now, you've got to remember, Scott, that Port Stephens is four times bigger than Sydney Harbour. And it is just a huge, huge waterway. And back in 1920s and 30s, there was actually an industry, a shark industry here inside Port Stephens, established at Pindyma. Now, Pindyma is only a little hamlet on the northern side of the port, and really it's quite an insignificant-looking place now, but a very quiet and beautiful little village right on the shoreline. Now, but back then, it was a hive of activity, and there was a bustling shark industry, which the reason the industry went broke was because they ran out of sharks. They processed 25,000 sharks here of all sorts, all types, and it was mainly what the main focus was the sales of cod liver oil, which wasn't cod liver oil at all. It was the oil made from the liver of sharks.
Wow. Did they process any other parts of the shark?
Yes, I'm told they did. I think they sort of had a market for the fins with the Asian people. Also, they processed the meat. How they did that, I'm not too sure. The whole thing was based around the liver. But sharks were just part of Port Stephens, really. And I've spoken to some of the old fishermen, and the stories are fantastic. Hard to believe, a lot of them. I mean, Ken Barry, who's recently passed away, told me that Fingal Bay, in front of my house, at certain times of the year, he said there were so many sharks. It was just thousands of sharks between here and Stockton, all sorts of sharks. And particularly around this time of the year, this is the end of the mullet season, but as soon as the mullet move, so too do the sharks.
Hey, I'm just having a look at an interesting history site on that Pindyma shark factory, and one photo they've got is of women's handbags and men's shoes and wallets all made out of tanned shark skin. I didn't know that you could wear shark skin shoes.
Well, if you can wear crocodile skin, I suppose you can wear shark skin. I don't know. But, I mean, some of the stories I saw was the trawler fleet here was quite large. Now, there are two trawlers. One, really, that works out of Port Stephens. But back in the 40s, there were around close to 30 trawlers that were working out of this port. And they would go down and trawl off the Stockton Beach, mainly for prawns and fish. And there was always someone on board, and I've spoken to a bloke called Johnny Ploy, who was a young Dutchman at the time, and he was employed to shoot sharks that attacked the fishing net. And I said to John, I said, on a day, how many sharks would you shoot with this big rifle? And he said, oh, sometimes 30 or 40 a day. And he said, we were on one boat that was out of Stockton. And he said, really, on a quiet day, with all the guns, because they had guns on board every boat, and he said it was like duck season. That was the exact words he said. There were so many sharks that was the only way they could control them. And there wasn't the environmental considerations that we have today.
Mm. It's interesting, isn't it, talking to marine scientists and experts too. They're vital in a healthy system because they don't really chase too many healthy fish, but they eat the ones that are slow or diseased or wounded, which keeps the stocks healthy as well. So they're like any apex predator. They have a really important role in the environment. But you don't have shark nets or drum lines, do you?
No, and never have had. And for well over 150 years, from all the research I've done, and I've delved into it very deeply, and to date, and we have never had a fatality. We've had shark attacks, some quite nasty ones. Not many. One, I think, about maybe 10 years ago, I think, would probably be the last. But as far as fatalities, we haven't had fatalities. Well, so you don't really have to overreact. We have no nets, we have no drum lines, and we have no fatalities. So you've got to sort of try and get a balanced approach to this issue. And I wonder, for those who do think that nets work, I mean, what evidence do they have to show that by using nets you're going to reduce fatalities or shark attacks? I'm quite open. I'm open to anything that people have got to say, and particularly any statistics that can prove that there's a better way of going about it. But we don't have anything like that. We don't have drones. We don't have anything. It's just that everybody jumps in, has a swim, and we're lucky, I suppose. I suppose that's probably the best thing we've got, is a lot of luck. But just one other thing, Scott. I remember a lady telling me many, many years ago that in the fishermen's co-op in Nelson Bay, when the trawlers would come in and unload their catch of the day, and a lot of it would be washed and spilled overboard. So around the fishermen's co-op was alive with sharks. And that's what, they just accepted that. And I'm not talking little sharks, I'm talking big sharks. And there was a young bloke, the postman's son here, oh golly, 1940s or 50s, and he fell in. He fell off a trawler and fell in the water. And fortunately, like I said before, there were guns on the boat. So everyone on boats around this boy, they would stand there with their guns loaded until the young bloke got out of the water. So there are so many stories about sharks, and this, it happens at this time every year. But there is a very serious side of it too, Scott, and that is that there have been horrific injuries and fatalities around the country. So what's the best way of controlling that? I don't think culling is the answer. I would be considering other ways of doing it before I went down that track.
It's the Big Fish, and we're speaking with Stinker. Stinker, we did get that photo up finally, the one of young Tarrant with that huge tailor. I mean, that thing is an absolute beast. If people go, just type in Jumbo Tailor, the Big Fish, and you'll see him holding that thing. It was very hard for me to size up to get it in frame. It was so long.
Yeah. Well, that wasn't the only big one. There were quite a few. A big tailor I mean, I don't know what it tastes like. I suppose it'd be all right. Oh, I can't imagine it. I'd be more inclined to smoke it, I think, rather than fry. I mean, I never knew the Taylor grew that big. And really, when you first lay eyes on it, you think, oh, it's been touched up, AI, and, you know, every way of manipulating photographs have been, but not the case. Because I went down, I saw them. I saw this, and Greg Tarrant and the Monin brothers, and they're the ones on the beach, the commercial fishermen. That's it. They said there's a magnificent tailor in the water, and there's mulloway in Fingal Bay too, swimming around in huge schools. But there are laws that apply to commercial fishing when it comes to mulloway and tailor. Look, this is a very exciting time of the year, Scott. There's a lot of fish in the water at this time of the year.
No, it's always good to see that cycle of life stinker. And thanks for your thoughts on what's going on at the moment. Catch you next time.
Hello, Scott.
The Big Fish with Scott Levi on ABC Radio.
And if you love a feed of oysters, as I do, I mean, Sydney Rock oysters are just the most luxurious, greatest food ever, then a very important message for you coming up next. Make sure you know where they've come from. If you're getting them in the restaurant, make sure you know the provenance, because there's been a big theft of oysters. 1,700 dozen have flooded onto the black market. We'll catch up with the oyster grower, and we'll catch up with the food expert as to why this is a dangerous thing.
Some folks are worried over how they'll pay the rent. Some folks are annoyed because they can't lay up a cent. Others are perplexed about the latest picture show. But there is really only just one thing I'd like to know. What kind of a noise annoys an oyster? No matter what I do, the answer won't come through. What kind of a noise annoys an oyster? That's the question I would like an answer to. Now simple things annoy a lot of simple folks, you see. And that's most likely why this question is annoying me. But what kind of a noise annoys an oyster? When an oyster's in a stew, doodle-doodle-doo-doo.
The Big Fish with Scott Levi on ABC Radio.
Matthew Jones is the general manager of Witten's Oyster Farm, West Gosford, and the whole of Brisbane Water pretty much is full of their leases. They're a big organisation. They work very, very hard. So to have their hard work ruined by thieves is really heartbreaking. Matthew, good morning.
Oh, good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Matthew, what was the extent of the theft? Have you been able to add up how much has been lost in those floating black baskets?
Yeah, look, so there's 160 bags that were stolen, and inside that you got about 20 dozen or 25 dozen per bag. So it's around about 20,000 oysters, around about 28 grams where the stock is gone, but 1,700 dozen is pretty much what's been stolen.
And they were the mature ones too. How long it had taken them to get to that really beautiful big stage, they are the cream of the crop, aren't they? The Brisbane Water Sydney Rock Oyster is nothing better.
Yeah, mate, that's what's ripped us about. We've been nursing these things for 2 years now, and now just about ready for market coming up for the October, November. So they are our biggest plates and large oysters. But 2 years, mate, of hard-earned work and people out there flipping them and nursing them to it, it's a bit devastating.
Yeah, it breaks your heart. Years of work. I believe another oyster grower heard about your plight and reached out to you, which must renew your faith in humankind a little bit.
Well, it renews my faith, and I'd like to thank Kylie and all them from the Melbourne, from Phillip Island area, which we're going to be putting some stuff on our socials to thank her. She's donating back to us 20,000 spat to take up to our nursery to start the whole process off again in Port Macquarie, and then we'll bring them down. But there are some good people.
And how can people help you catch the crooks and New South Wales Maritime and Water Police onto it? I mean, there'd surely be ways to catch them when you look at this massive amount of money stolen.
Yeah, well, look, the way we're looking at it right now, we've got the police, and we're hoping the police are going to help us. We're getting all the CCTV footage of every boat ramp that's connected to the Brisbane Water or that area location that we're got that theft from. If we can see any empty punts coming in and, you know, on the cameras and then going out fully loaded, we know that it's done externally. And they've gone into the middle of our lease at the right time of tide, so we know the person's very familiar with the tides and the areas. They've gone into the middle, taken that, and then taken it out. If it's gone externally and it hasn't been purified, the potential of people getting sick and all that sort of stuff, that's what was on our mind as well.
Yeah, that's right. We'll talk to a food safety expert to get his view, because it can be very, very dangerous, if not deadly, eating black market oysters. And to make it even worse, the sewage plant has had a spill, which is something you're working with council to try to stop, because they're really impacting your farming, aren't they?
It's something that needs to be. This has been going for years and years, you know, decades. And the thing that we keep saying to the council is, you've got to get a better system with your sewage system and stuff like that. You just can't dump sewage into the water systems. Now, we, as I said, our oysters are an eco part of the ecosystem for the waterways. We clean the Brisbane waters, because every oyster cleans, you know, 150 litres through their oysters every day of water. And whatever's in the water, it filters and puts it back. So we clean the waters, and then they have a bit of rain, and then they go, you know what, bang, we're going to drop some sewer straight into the water areas, and it's around all our leases. And that's one of the things we really need to get this certified. It can be fixed. It's just that no one seems to be wanting to put the money towards fixing the piping. And every time they bring more people into Brisbane, in the Brisbane water areas or the council, it puts more load on the waterway. So if it rains, it just builds up, and then bang, straight into our waterways, which then everybody's off work for four or five weeks.
And then when you can harvest, you then put them through your own filtration plant. Is that right? You've got a few days of filtration in special tanks to make sure that any bugs are killed.
Yeah, because we're that big. As I said, we have 156 hectares of the water. We have our own purification tanks. We have three massive purification tanks, and they've got to go into the water in purifier for 36 hours, and then puts it through a process through the UV lights and all that sort of stuff. And then we go from there, bag up, then it gets graded, and then it goes to the opening rooms and stuff like that. But at the moment, you know, we're closed now for, you know, I think just on since the 27th, we've been closed, and we can't do a thing at the moment with our own leases. So we have to buy oysters from other parts of Australia to keep our supplies up to our customers.
Matthew, it's a very tough job being an oyster farmer. Doesn't help with people stealing your stock. Let's hope the authorities can catch them.
Oh, we can get assistance from the public to help us, you know, help out with finding these people. That would be our first thank you call to everybody. Wait, we'll even get a reward if it comes to someone finding out who this bloke is. And secondly, if we can just get some more people talking about, you know, the farmers, because we've lost six farmers in the last 6 years because, you know, they close them down and they can't run, and it puts them out of business. So the council and the sewage system and fixing up the waterways, mate, that's our ultimate goal.
You work so hard. It's a great product, the best oyster in the world, yeah. The Sydney Rock Oyster. Anyway, people are looking for a large flat-bottom punt and probably operating it in the night. And if they saw it loaded with black baskets.
Look, it's not a one-man job. So it's not just a one-man job. It would have been two to three people in which to do this. So there's other people out there that know about it. And that's what we're saying. It's not just one person.
It's a major theft, isn't it? What sort of money are we talking about?
Over $28,000 just in oysters, and then it's not including the bags. You know, the bags are $15 each. So you times one bag times 160 gives you a shocking number.
Yeah, and you just bought in another $40,000 worth of bags. Yeah. I hear, and to have them stolen. It's just a real blow. Look, good luck, and keep farming, and such a clean, green. And massive industry here on the coast. It's a tough one, though. Matthew Jones, thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much for helping me out. Appreciate it.
Oyster grower Matthew Jones there. And to make matters worse, I checked out the Food Safety New South Wales website, and those oysters were stolen during a closure due to that sewage spill. And so the oyster farmer wasn't allowed to harvest, but the thieves took them when it was closed for health and safety reasons. So those oysters that are circulating on the black market now could be deadly. We'll catch up with the food safety expert, Gary Kennedy, in just a moment.
The Big Fish with Scott Levi on ABC Radio.
What could be the health impacts of eating those oysters, particularly after the heavy rain? And now we hear that they were stolen when the lease was technically closed due to a sewer overflow. Joining us, food safety expert Gary Kennedy.
Good morning, Scott.
Gary, what sort of health problems could arise from consuming these stolen oysters?
Well, some people may remember the Wallace Lake outbreak that happened in the 1990s, where about, well, over 1,000 people got hepatitis from eating oysters. And after that, they changed the whole way that oysters are harvested. So the first thing is this oyster lease was shut because of a sewerage outbreak. And after heavy rain and an incident like that, the first thing is the oysters aren't allowed to be picked for a few days. And that's because oysters are filter feeders. So there could be things inside them, you know, microorganisms that cause food poisoning. And two notable ones are the bacteria E. coli, sometimes called Escherichia coli, and hepatitis A can both be found in dirty water. Basically, they're found, sorry, people having breakfast, they're found in human poo and animal poo. And so you're not allowed to harvest oysters after heavy rain or after a sewerage outbreak, like the farmer was talking about. So the first thing is the oysters may have bugs inside them that can cause food poisoning. Now, when you harvest oysters, there's something you have to do called depuration. And depuration means you put the oysters into fresh water for a minimum 36 hours, and they basically purge or spew the contents of their guts out. So if there is any hepatitis or other bug in there, it goes out into the water, and that water is recirculated through ultraviolet light to sterilize it. So the oysters that we get in the market that have been harvested legally from the lease have all been treated, so there's no food poisoning bugs in there, if all that makes sense.
It does indeed. And what about then storage and sale? Because that's also a period of time where the legitimate suppliers and growers do the right thing, isn't it? And that's another danger time.
Yeah, well, you know, an oyster is an oyster in its shell, before it's unshucked, which is the word for opening the shell, before it's unshucked, the oyster is actually a live animal, so you've got to keep it under certain conditions. So there are Sydney rock oysters will keep for about 14 days if they're kept under the correct conditions. And Sydney rock oysters, if you put them in a cold fridge, and people have heard me on afternoon say your fridges should be less than 5 degrees for food safety, but you don't do that for a rock oyster. If you put it into a really cold fridge, it actually kills the oyster. And so oysters typically are kept from 10 to 20 degrees. So if the people who have stolen the oysters put these oysters in the fridge, they'll actually kill them. And even putting them on ice will kill them as well. And if an oyster's, you can tell if an oyster's dead because the shell opens when they're dead. And anyone who has seen an oyster will know those shells are pretty tightly shut. And or even put, you got to keep them damp as well. If they dry out, they die. And so when you go to a lease, you'll often see oysters are in hessian sacks and they wet the sacks, and that keeps the oysters moist. But even putting them in long periods under fresh water will kill them as well. So they're a bit delicate when they come out. But I suppose for consumers, if you get these oysters and the shells are open, they're dead. Don't eat them. That means they're starting to rot, because oysters will rot fairly quickly. They're raw seafood.
Gary, thanks for your great knowledge there. It really does ring the alarm bells. People should not at any point eat or consume or buy black market oysters. The market will be flooded with around 1,700 dozen great big premium Sydney rock oysters. Know their provenance. Buy from a proper person. And thank you so much for the advice, Gary Kennedy.
No problem, Scott.
Food scientist and food safety expert.
The Big Fish with Scott Levi on ABC Radio.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listener.